My name is Yuka Koshino, and I'm with the Japan Chair at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. The Japan Chair seeks to define a strategic agenda for the U.S.-Japan alliance in a bilateral, regional, and global context. So we launched a Strategic Japan Initiative to incorporate the views and scholarship of Japanese experts in the policy debate here in Washington. For the Strategic Japan Program's sixth year, we invited four scholars from Japan to address the Free and Open Indo-Pacific Vision, or FOIP, as it is animating the foreign policy agendas of Japan, the U.S., and other regional countries. Today, we welcome Mr. Ryosuke Hanada, a fellow with the Japan Institute of International Affairs. He discusses the role of cooperation between the U.S., Japan, Australia, and India, or the Quad, in FOIP. Our moderator is Japan Chair Adjunct Fellow John Hemmings.
It gives me great pleasure to be sitting in here, Ryosuke Hanada, and discussing the Quad after our roundtable that we held here yesterday at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Welcome, Ryosuke.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
So, Ryosuke, let's dive right in. You had, I think, one of the most interesting topics, which is the Quad or the quadrilateral. Can you tell me, what exactly is the Quad for our listeners at home?
John, thank you very much for inviting me to this really fascinating roundtable discussion and podcast. About the Quad, is a cooperation among the four countries, Australia, Japan, India, and the United States. And it's actually originated in 2004. And after the Boxing Day tsunami incident in Indonesia, the four navies had a HADR, Humanitarian Assistance and then Disaster Relief Exercise. That's the origin, actually. The contour of the Quad was created by Prime Minister Abe around 2006. He had some concept of the security diamond, or democratic security diamond cooperation. It's part of his freedom, arc of the freedom and prosperity concept in foreign policy. It's revived in 2017 with sort of the senior diplomatic meetings held alongside the East Asia Summit or Shangri-La Dialogue. So that's the Quad. One thing I want to emphasize is that the importance of the trilateral and the bilateral under the Quad. There's a six bilaterals and four triangles under the Quad. Those are the actually very important components of the Quad, which actually make some progress and cooperation.
So a couple things that I'm just going to pick out there that I think are really interesting. First of all is the fact that it has this kind of DNA from Japan. You know, this seems to be one of the first, I suppose, alignment pushes or shifts in U.S. regional strategy, and it has a very strong Japanese imprint. And I think this is one of the things that's been increasingly clear is that Japan is not just a kind of willing, submissive partner to the U.S. in alliance strategy, but increasingly a kind of driving partner and an editor of U.S. policy preferences and choices. You're absolutely right to pinpoint the tsunami as that kind of once-in-a-generation opportunity for those states to realize some kind of potentialities that were already present. What does that say about the Quad? Does it have a kind of grassroots, bottom-up approach, or do you think Abe's leadership and driving energy were responsible for the continuation of the Quad?
Well, I think actually it's a combination of top-down and bottom-up approach. Regarding the concept, which originated in the bottom-up, it's the Navy-to-Navy, military-to-military cooperation, but the frameworks was actually created by Prime Minister Abe or advisors to him. But at the same time, as I pointed out the importance of the bilateral and trilateral, the actual cooperation were accumulated through the working level or practitioners level cooperation. My analysis in my paper, which will be published in the CSI Strategic Japan Program, addresses the four dimensions of power: diplomacy, information, military, and economy. And in terms of diplomatic aspect, which was actually top-down, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs or other foreign ministries actually take an initiative to create some consultative mechanism, talking about broader issue, including the connectivity, importance of rule of law, maritime security, and so on. But other three dimensions, information, military, and economy, that's a basically bottom-up in terms of information. Still, four countries are not sharing information, but the trilateral, like US, Japan, Australia, which are connected with alliances, are now sharing defense-related information among the three countries. Japan and India are now connected with the sort of information security arrangement, which just settles the same criteria for the secrecy, state secrecy.
Is that like a GSOMIA?
It's not that level. it's like the foundation of having the GSOMIA. Mm. Setting the both countries' domestic rules, I mean, just comparing them and then matching the different criteria that's used in respective countries. Militarily, there's a trilateral naval exercise among US, Japan, India, which is called the Malabar exercise. Now Japan is a regularized participant. Japan, US, Australia, again, have cooperated significantly, and they have improved interoperability thanks to the alliances with the United States. And US-Japan, of course, alliance, US-Australia, US-India, and even recently, India and Australia have conducted a bilateral military exercise. So I think it's actually the bottom-up in that sense. And finally, about economy, there's no trade agreement among the four countries. We shouldn't be too ambitious about a Quad. There's no TPP, there's no RCEP, but they are now talking about the regional connectivity, which is very important because of China's Belt and Road Initiative. China is now providing some idea of connecting the sort of Indo-Pacific region of Chinese version. The problem of the BRI includes, for example, the debt trap or low-quality infrastructure. And I think Australia, Japan, and the United States are now trying to provide an alternative to this BRI model. In that sense, the Quad may play some important role, I guess.
You've given me a lot there, and I want to come back to connectivity in a moment because I think that's a huge chunk of where the Quad's going. But before we get there, I really like how you mentioned that there's these trilaterals and bilaterals inside the Quad. And of course, you know, the US, Japan, Australia trilateral is a kind of significant shaper and origin point of the Quad, given all of its DNA and the security interoperability aspect, the intelligence sharing aspect. And one of the points that comes of this, of course, that you said is there's alliances inside the Quad, which of course raises this massive point that is the Quad itself an alliance? I have some views on this, but I'd first like to hear yours. Is the Quad an alliance? If so, why? If not, why not?
I think Quad is not alliance. I want to make it clear because there's no mutual security treaty among the four countries. There's no collective security obligations. So even if India is attacked, no other countries are obliged to declare war against India's adversary. But at the same time, we have to understand the importance of security partnership, which is not necessarily the alliance, but a partnership, for example, is based on the shared strategic visions and values. So the four countries are now sharing the security partnership, and they are sharing the strategic objective, which is basically the rules-based order, maintaining the rules-based order in this region. And rules-based order, for example, includes the freedom of the sea lanes of communication from the Middle East to Northeast Asia, which is very important for Japan's energy import. So in that sense, well, answering to your question, Quad is not alliance, but at the same time, which is becoming the very important core framework for security partnership in this Indo-Pacific region. And I'd like to hear your thought on this.
I cannot disagree with a single word you said. I think in terms of, you know, the alliance literature and international relations scholarship, the common denominator of all alliance definitions seems to be some sort of either stated or unstated obligation to defend one or mutual, or some political cost if a state is attacked by an enemy and there's no response. In this case, I don't think anyone asserts that. And in fact, they go out of their way to say it's not one. But what's fascinating about the Quad and about the trilaterals, of course, is that they're quasi-alliances or virtual alliances. Everyone uses that language. And I suppose that's because they are hybrids in a sense. They have this stuff that allies do together inside the packaging, military to military, strategic talks, high levels of classified talks, anti-submarine warfare exercises, of course, as we know, extremely sensitive for partner militaries to get involved in. So there is that sense that there's a kind of a struggle, you know, between entrapment on the one hand inside a larger alliance that you don't want to be entrapped and being abandoned and isolated in the face of a growing regional power, China. Before I go directly to connectivity, I'll go into the wider debate that we've been having that your roundtable has been a part of. And of course, that's FOIP, the Free and Open Indo-Pacific. Where does the Quad sit within the FOIP, within the Free and Open Indo-Pacific? What's the relationship between the two?
I think there are basically two views regarding the relationship between the FOIP and the Quad. One would argue that the Quad is the fundamental, integral part of the FOIP. Then the other would argue that it's not. Quad is separated from the Free and Open Indo-Pacific. So first of all, what I understand FOIP is that it's the diplomatic initiative to protect the rules-based order. There's a US FOIP and a Japanese FOIP. And when it comes to Japanese version of the Free and Open Indo-Pacific, it's trying to, first of all, protect the regional security, especially maritime security. And second, promoting the transparent infrastructure in this region. And third is promoting the universal values, including democracy, freedom of speech, and the rule of law in this region, in the whole Indo-Pacific region. And in that sense, I think the Quad, I believe, have some space to play in this free and open Indo-Pacific vision or strategy. The Quad is actually still low-key and ambiguous in terms of their strategic objectives. But as I said before, one of the shared objectives is protecting this rules-based concept in the Indo-Pacific region, and the four countries, all democracy, maritime states, and importantly, great powers. Australia and Japan are not necessarily, or India are not necessarily great powers compared to the size of the United States or China, but they are at least the significant players in this region, and compared to, for example, the Southeast Asian states. So I think in order to protect the rules-based order, the cold reality is that we should have this appropriate balance of power, and the Quad would play that role. If we are aligned in the security area, for example, it certainly provides a certain counterbalance to increasing China's military capability. Of course, there must be some challenges that we are not having the alliance, we are not taking a collective action on the certain issue. That's still a limitation of the Quad. But I think at least at this moment, even though it's maybe a bit symbolic, it has some meaning to promote the concept of the free and open Indo-Pacific. I mean, the Quad can play some role in the promotion of the free and open Indo-Pacific, I think.
You mentioned the Quad members are looking at the freedom of the seas, and of course there's that connectivity issue with the infrastructure that involves often ports that China's building, the leverage that it gives it across its string of pearls, if we still use that phrase. And then they also do values, you know, rules-based order, infrastructure, values. So there's a whole kind of medley of arrows to be fired here, and it raises the question, what should the Quad do? What can the Quad do? Should it have a trade component? Should it be driving that infrastructure alternative, as you discuss? Or should it remain purely security-oriented? And if so, how much security should it do?
Just before answering to that question directly, I'd like to just understand the driving force of the Quad. Back to 2000, mid-2000, the major global risk was terrorism. And then in this maritime security area, the maritime terrorists and also some non-traditional threats, including the disaster, piracy, and others. As I said at the beginning, the origin of the Quad is 2004 disaster relief exercise. But after 2010, or around 2008 actually, the major challenge has shifted to the traditional security, which is basically about China's military maritime expansion. So this is the actually now current driving force for the Quad members to cooperate. So from that point, what should Quad do? The major challenge, I mean, still, so it means that we have the two types of challenge, non-traditional type of challenge, and also the traditional challenge posed by China. So regarding the non-traditional area, as I said, we can accumulate the bottom-up cooperation among the militaries, especially navies. They should do more to enhance maritime domain awareness capability of themselves, or capacity building, providing capacity building services to Southeast Asia to improve the safety of the sea. On the other hand, well, that's already conducted, implemented. And on the other hand, regarding China, the Quad hasn't done actually so much thing. For example, the three countries, Australia, Japan, United States, for example, have not only enhanced the interoperability, but also clearly criticized China's ignorance of the arbitration award, which was issued in July 2016. So that's actually giving some legitimacy for the trilateral cooperation. Trilateral cooperation is not just countering or not for containing China, but for protecting the concept principle rule of law, which benefits China as well. But I think the Quad, as a Quad, so far, I haven't seen the strong collective action against China's attempt to change the status quo in the South China Sea or East China Sea, or even in the Indian Ocean. What we have done are, for example, providing alternative to infrastructure, which related to connectivity things, and the maritime security. Four countries have participated in the several maritime exercises. And I mean, not four countries, but the three countries have accumulated the maritime exercise. So it's a bit controversial, but I think situation in the South China Sea hasn't changed even after the Quad re-emerged in 2017. China's militarization has progressed. Four countries haven't, not successful to deter China's those attempt to change the status quo, I think. So we have to do more.
I think I know to some extent where you're going with this, because if you look at the Triple Entente in pre-World War I, First World War period, you have a quasi-alliance of some sort between the UK, France, and Russia. Certainly the French-Russia side, there's mutual commitments, but on the British side, fairly non-committal. And of course, the question is, why do states align with each other? So even, I suppose, classical realist arguments, they align because they perceive threat to be in their interest, threat to be in the region, and so they respond by seeking security. And of course, the Quad looks like they're seeking security as an alliance-type group. But then the problem is, of course, there's no mutual defense commitment. So it's a kind of sham alliance, in a sense. I wonder, does it do what it says on the tin? And I think that's been, you know, it hasn't been able to stop the South China Sea island building. It hasn't even really been able to issue collective diplomatic statements of intent or anything like that. As you know, I'm personally very interested in the Quad and the trilaterals, these kind of new hybrid beasts. The question raises, like, what do they do? You know, what are they for? And are they underbalancing, as an IR scholar might put it?
I think we shouldn't be too ambitious about the Quad. That's what I tried to say in the previous answer. But at the same time, I'm not denying the importance of Quad. I think one of the most important aspects of the Quad is diplomatic consultation or coordination mechanism. As I said, there's a bilaterals and trilaterals, but they are not coordinated. They are coordinated within each foreign ministry of respective country, and they are trying to manage in their bilateral and trilateral and the quadrilateral. But the quadrilateral framework itself can play the role to coordinate different triangles and different bilateral lines. And that's the area we can seek more. There's the three senior diplomatic meetings held in the past 2 years. That's the good beginning point for this consultation or coordination mechanism. And for example, as I said, there's a capacity building to Southeast Asian states, and already Japan, US, Australia have done a lot. But there must be some role for India to play in this capacity building. India is using the Russian equipment. Still, 60% of the equipment maybe are Russian. So there are some countries in Southeast Asia like Vietnam, which also rely on the Russian equipment. So Japan, Australia, United States may have some difficulty to provide a capacity building to Vietnam, for example. Or even though Japan did support to law enforcement agency, but when it comes to the Navy, we can invite India to the capacity building of those countries, which are not necessarily relying on the United States to the same extent that Japan and Australia rely on the United States.
So they can provide some sort of regional balancing by providing capacity here and there. I wonder if, you know, this is probably the biggest question for a lot of practitioners, is will they be able to, you know, restart the quadrilateral military exercises, which, you know, if we track the trilateral exercises with Australia, the US, and Japan, they've become extremely hard. You know, they're war fighting Guam North, I think there's Pacific Bond, there's Southern Jackaroo. You know, they're very impressive, the amount of men and material that are being used in those annual exercises on Tri-Services, ASW, and electronic warfare, I think, for the Guam ones. Can we imagine or see the Quad going down that direction and improving interoperability on the military exercises level? And hidden in that question, you'll notice, is the question about India and Australia relations, because we know behind the failure for resurrected quadrilateral Malabar is the Indian disenchantment with Australia for the failure of the first Quad 1.0.
I think we are now on the trajectory to this quadrilateral joint military exercise. Of course, you pointed out some difficulty between Australia and India, but if their relationship is completely bad, Australia and India had some problem when it comes to the first Quad in 2007 because of Kevin Rudd's withdrawal. And Kevin Rudd also suspended uranium export to India at the time. So that's also became the controversial issue for India, which tried to seek, still seeking the nuclear supplier group's participation. On the other hand, I have to say the bilateral exercise has just started last year. So at the military level, there's an emerging convergence of interest between the Indian and Australian navies, especially importance of the Indian Ocean's security. India is not necessarily interested in the South China Sea or even East China Sea or the Western Pacific. But the important thing for the Quad is we can think about a priority area for respective country. India should play more role in the Indian Ocean, and they can help get the support from United States, Australia, and Japan. And when it comes to the South China Sea, U.S. would play the primary role, and having the support from Australia, Japan, and a little bit from India in terms of capacity building, for example. That would be still possible. And regarding your question about the joint exercise, I think, yes, there's still difficulty, but I think there's some improvement between India and Australia to some extent.
Can I pick you up on that point about India and the South China Sea? Because I suppose what I find puzzling is the way that countries react to the South China Sea doesn't always fit the amount of dependence that they have on it. So, for example, the United States is, to some extent, carrying the burden for the South China Sea. According to the China Power CSIS figures, only 5% of its trade goes through the South China Sea, whereas India must be much higher. But I know it's a significant portion of Indian ASEAN trade, Indian Japan trade. Why is that? Why do you feel that the Indians not feel as strongly about the South China Sea?
I think it's just a matter of the priority. I'm not saying that India is not interested in the South China Sea, but given the increase in the presence of China in the Indian Ocean region, like the Guadal, Hambantota, Djibouti,
they've got problems closer to home.
Yes, so it's more closer to home. And India has the dual identity as a continental state and a maritime state. And the maritime state's identity are now emerging. But still, regarding the military expenditure, still they spend a significant amount of money to ground force. So I think
the army still gets the lion's share.
Yeah, the lion's share, that's true. So even if India is has a significant interest in the South China Sea, there's a limitation of resource within the domestic military expenditure, and there's an emerging challenge posed by China in the Indian Ocean, the most proximate area for India. So I think that's why I'm saying that they are not necessarily engaging in the situation in the South China Sea.
Moving from maritime security to the issue that you raised earlier, which is, of course, connectivity, the rise of China's Belt and Road Initiative and its Maritime Silk Road and the kind of extension of infrastructure, but also the role that that infrastructure has in developing Chinese power and sea lane control. What should the Quad be thinking in terms of its own infrastructure policies? Should they recreate their own Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank? Should they do things separately? And where do you see the Quad going in terms of infrastructure development?
I think there must be three approaches for the Quad countries. One is using the existing International Multilateral Development Bank, namely Asian Development Bank, ADB, and the World Bank. Even though there's some gap between their capability or their capital and the demand for infrastructure in this region, we still have to reactivate the existing institutions. And we can also utilize the AIIB, Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. India, Australia are the members of the AIIB. So even though Japan is in the United States out of the AIIB, I think India and Australia should play some role to correcting the AIIB's investment. And the ADB, AIIB are already cooperating significantly in the infrastructure investment. Second thing is again using the trilateral. Australia, Japan, and the United States have already agreed on the investment cooperation, infrastructure investment cooperation, involving the DFAT, Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, and JBIC, Japan Bank for International Cooperation, and EFIC of the United States. So that's basically different from the BRI approach in the sense that three countries try to invite more private sectors to this infrastructure investment. Chinese model is more like a state-led model, and state-decided project, and the state will fund and send in the Chinese labors and the capitals and the materials to those projects. Japanese or our trilateral approach is more like having a different approach. So that's the second approach. The third one would be, well, there might be some role for the Quad. Again, it's not a quadrilateral investment. The Quad should think about broader regional connectivity vision. Trilateral Australia, Japan, US basically focus on the Pacific Island and Southeast Asia. It's not necessarily covering the Indian Ocean or broader Indian continent. And India's idea, like Asia-Africa Economic Corridor, is thinking about the connectivity between Africa and Asia. Japan-India cooperation is targeting the Bay of Bengal, but all of them are separated at this moment. And the Quad, if there's any role for the Quad can think about beyond this separated regional initiative of, under the trilateral or bilateral initiatives. That's, I think, the area the policymakers can think quite creatively, I think.
So it's interesting. There seems to be in the Quad a certain level of, a bit like NATO became in the 2000s, you know, different countries can do different areas. They can do different skill sets they bring to the table. So South Pacific would be Australia, US, Japan, then Japan, India in the Western Indian Ocean. What about in India itself? I mean, of course, what we often forget is that one of the Quad members itself is a massive country that is in dire need for infrastructure. How do we help India gain the infrastructure it needs? But just that final question, does the Quad have a view on helping India develop its infrastructure?
India's infrastructure need is especially urgent in the northeastern part, Arunachal Pradesh, and then the so-called chicken's neck area, which has only the, you know, small territory connecting to the Northeast Asian, northeast part, and then the main part of India. And the other one is Andaman Nicobar, which is very close to the Malacca Strait. For those two areas, I think in terms of the first northeastern part, which is facing China, border to border. So if their infrastructure development is lagging behind, they would be so vulnerable. And that could be the power vacuum. And there's the shared interest for the Quad is preventing the power vacuum in this region. So helping India develop the infrastructure in this part would be significant, I think. Andaman Nicobar is very significant for protecting the Malacca Strait, western part of Malacca Strait, actually, which is, of course, I mean, to prevent the China's changing status quo, but also for preventing the piracy and then also providing the safety for the commercial vessels in this region. So if India install some radar system in this area for improving MDA capability, that would be good. And if India, for example, deployed a US-2, which is still under the negotiation with Japan, the amphibious aircraft, the search and rescue capability of India will be improved. That's also good for anyone, everybody, including any country's commercial vessel. So I think this is, of course, for India, but it's for the region. And final thought on this is that we should think about not just India's infrastructure. India should be connected to the Central Asia, Bay of Bengal, and even the western part like Iran, the Chabahar. It's a bit sensitive part for cooperation, but Central Asia and the Bay of Bengal would be considered seriously because those countries, which are very close to India, are feeling the pressure of India's growth. We have to provide some reassurance to those neighboring countries that India will not become the hegemonic power in this region. That's another role, difficult task for the Quad, actually.
Going forward, where do you see the Quad going? How do you see it developing? How do you see it in its relationship with China? How do you see the Quad relating also particularly to ASEAN? So I suppose a kind of general question, a very China-focused question, and an ASEAN-focused question.
China one. From the China's perspective, Quad is certainly annoyance. The more Quad has done or can do, the more pressure China feels. And then the Quad is different from the trilateral US, Australia, Japan because it's not connected with the alliance. But that has another positive meaning. China understands that Australia, United States, and Japan would object to China's changing the status quo. But if India joined this objection or criticism, China get the message more seriously. So even though now the Quad is still low-key and ambiguous, I think it's strategically ambiguous, we have to use this Quad or the improvement or the functionality or institutionalization as the bargaining chip against China. If China did something, we have to improve the Quad relationship as a response. It's not retaliation, but it's making some signal that the four countries wouldn't allow the further change of the status quo.
A natural consequence of international relations scholarship, which predicts that when states' interests are more threatened, they bind together more closely. What about ASEAN?
ASEAN feels also the fierce pressure from the Quad. What ASEAN wants to protect is ASEAN centrality in regional cooperation frameworks. ASEAN Regional Forum, East Asia Summit, ASEAN Defense Ministers Meeting Plus, that's all centering on ASEAN. And ASEAN is playing not just the center in the sense of the institutional membership, but also the normative sense. ASEAN's norm, ASEAN's way, like non-intervention and consensus-based decision-making, is embedded in those kind of multilateral regional institutions. And what ASEAN wants to protect is this normative and actual institutional centrality. And the Quad may pose some threats to those centrality, because if Quad are really aligned and they try to take the initiative in the regional cooperation, well, ASEAN will be marginalized. But I think this is a great chance for ASEAN to rethink about their role and their way of thinking. ASEAN has been the five countries during the Cold War time and expanded to the 10 member after the Cold War. So during the bipolar world, ASEAN was actually divided. Current ASEAN was divided into the continental and the maritime Southeast Asia. And the post-Cold War U.S. unipolar world enabled them to have the comprehensive 10 membership. Now, we are now facing the new type of the great power rivalry between United States and China. In order for ASEAN to keep the unity and the current membership, I think they have to really think about the further integration beyond ASEAN way. ASEAN way is necessary for the culturally, politically, and traditionally, historically diverse country to be aligned or to be associated. But I think given China's attempts to drive in the wedge in ASEAN in terms of the sensitive security issue like South China Sea, ASEAN is already divided. In fact, ASEAN is already divided. So ASEAN have to think of changing its non-intervention principle and the consensus-based decision-making process to more sort of relaxed form. So relaxing the rules form sounds a bit weird, but having the more majority-based decision-making, and then also going back to the ASEAN Charter, which was agreed in 2007 or 8, I think, ASEAN's Charter stipulates not just the harmful terms like the consensus or non-intervention, but also democracy, human right, and rule of law. So they have the basis, the basic values that ASEAN embraces. So they have to go back to this point. And in order to protect those ASEAN charter, they have to think realistically with potential cooperation with the Quad countries. They have to open up the options. They don't feel threatened by the Quad. The Quad and ASEAN are actually aligned in the sense of shared objective. They are both trying to protect the rules-based order. Then the important thing is whether ASEAN can graduate from just thinking about the centrality to thinking about the rules-based order or preferable international order for themselves.
Ryosuke Honada, that was a superb discussion. I really enjoyed having you on this podcast. Thank you very much for coming to Washington.
My
and
pleasure.
Thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you very much, John. My pleasure.
Thanks for listening. For more about Japan and our research, visit us at the CSIS website's Japan Chair page.